Brother Bob has chosen as his subject Zion, Zionism, and Zionists. Zion, Zionism, and Zionists. Keep your hands up until you make sure that you get an outline. We'll turn the meeting over to Brother Bob.
Thank you, Brother David and Brother Irwin, and also, brethren, for your encouraging thoughts and words and prayers as we attempt to follow the beautiful music and singing of the brethren and the children. There are hands up, of course, and I want to apologize about yesterday. Evidently, I didn't make it clear that there were many more handouts for yesterday's discourse in a box on the outside table. And if you didn't see them coming in and you didn't get one, please take one on your way out. But these handouts, of course, are for you now, and we'll be using them. One of the things that you'll find out about this talk is that it's about Zion, about Zionism and about Zionists. And again, we bring to those of you who did not receive it yesterday the love of our home ecclesia. We are very thankful to be here with you. We wish they could all be here with us as well. Thanks, Brother Dan. Dan is always there to help you when you're fumbling. Thank you. We want to thank not only the ecclesia, but also the many hands that are behind the scenes, the elders, the deacons, everyone who's put their hands into these beautiful lessons. You know, when I think of Zion and when I think of Israel, I think of some pictures I have in my mind and from some of the presentations we've done in the past with video. Today's handout is kind of a poor man's PowerPoint, if you will. But anyway, the pictures would have been beautiful to see. But try to picture in your minds some of the settlers who were there at Petah Tikva or in the years that followed, trying to protect themselves from various rampaging natives who didn't appreciate them coming, but who nevertheless benefited from them financially and otherwise. And they sat in the evenings after dark, and they sat perhaps around campfires. And you know what they sang together? I remember hearing the strains of Hatikva at Mishkolz when our brother Adrian was playing that. It was a very beautiful sound. And they sang Hatikva, Hatikva, hope, because in the 1880s they were playing Hatikva. Brother Adrian, please, for us. What is Zionism? Is it of God? Is Zion simply spiritual, a spiritual kingdom? Is there an earthly Zion? If there is an earthly Zion, is Zion on God's heart? Let's read together from Zechariah Chapter 8, verses 2 and 3, which is on your handout, and you can follow if you like. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. For Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof as a lamp that burneth. And when we hear those words, we say to ourselves, but of course, what would we expect from an Old Testament prophet? But notice Jesus, recorded in Acts 1, 6 and 7, when the apostles were asking him shortly after his death and resurrection, When they therefore were gathered together and asked of him, saying, Wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And he said unto them, It is not for you to know the times and seasons which the Father hath put in his own power. You know, he didn't say, Restore the kingdom to Israel? They just crucified me. Why would I want to restore the kingdom to Israel? But that's not what he said, was it? It was in the Lord, his Father's hands and power to do that when he would and when he will. Israel's hope for Messiah was to have the kingdom restored. The disciples reflected that view. The promise that David's heir would reign forever and ever. The Hebrew is Olam Va'ad, and in the Hebrew it means to the age and onward. Jesus acknowledged the kingdom. He acknowledged that it would be reestablished, but the timing was in God's hands. Along with Zion, Zionism, and Zionists, there is the anti-Zionism, perhaps we might say, and even specifically the anti-Semitism. A brief history of the Christian-Jewish relations. In the first century, persecution upon Christians came under the hand of Jewish leadership, at least until the temple was destroyed. The second century, third century persecutions came mostly at the hands of the emperors, picking on the leadership for the most part. In the third and fourth centuries, on into beyond that, there was replacement theology introduced, which we'll hope to come to later. And then, of course, finally, the Imperial Roman persecution of Jews. When Constantine entered the stage, the Roman Empire provided muscle. Muscle to a church that had become anti-Semitic. And the mystery of iniquity began to speak with the power of Constantine and his heirs and those who followed them. In a sense, anti-Semitism became law. It became what the empire was thinking. And when we come down to the days of Theodosius, a very peculiar event occurs. And Richard Rubinstein calls it to our attention in his book, When Jesus Became God. You may have heard one of the brethren speak to this, about this book even. It's a very worthwhile book to read, by the way, When Jesus Became God. Theodosius was emperor of Rome from about 379 to 395, and according to Rubinstein, he planned at one point to protect those who were being persecuted, those heretics who were Arian, and those Jews who lived in the Mesopotamia region. And he wanted to stand up for them, because after all, how could he, an emperor, allow something like this to happen in his empire? Ambrose of Milan, the bishop, said that he could hardly offer him Holy Communion in good conscience if he were to slow down the work of other Christians who were persecuting Jews and Arians. And so the emperor capitulated to a threat of excommunication from Ambrose, the bishop of Milan. And I would think that began a long slide for emperors to capitulate to the priesthood of the Christian church, which had become soiled and tarnished. If you've never heard of Joshua Trachtenberg, there is his name mentioned on the back, and he traces the anti-Semitic persecutions and how graphically they were drawn, even in woodcuts of the Middle Ages, in his book, The Devil and the Jews. That kind of woodcut, or rather graphic demonstrations, was picked up by the Nazis during the 30s and 40s, and even in modern times by the Islamic press. All you have to do is check out Arutz Sheva, which is an internet site, IsraelNationalNews.com, or IsraelNN, if you will, IsraelNN.com, and check out some of the information on there about anti-Semitism and what the Arabs are putting in their press. Today in the 21st century, there are those like David Brog and the person he works for, John Hagee, who are trying to stand up for Israel. Brog is Jewish. Hagee is a Pentecostal minister. But he has his Standing with Israel and his In Defense of Israel. Each of them have their own books on this. And they present the ideas that the Christian community really should be in harmony and supporting the Jewish people. And frankly speaking, they get out there in front with millions of dollars to benefit. To benefit whom? To benefit Israel. In a book by Max Eidemont, there is a statement made that Martin Luther had really done some... Well, let me back up a second. Eidemont makes a comment that the Crusades were terrible, but that the Jews were incidental victims. I think that perhaps Eidemont was being politically correct even there, because there was so much persecution by the common person. It wasn't the intent of the Crusades, but the common person had been so well established in anti-Semitism that to carry out some anti-Semitic acts en route to Jerusalem, and then when they got there to dump on the Jewish community viciously, was because of the training of years of anti-Semitism from the church. It's this fellow Brog, David Brog, who says that Martin Luther missed a great opportunity to stick with and be behind the Jewish people. But of course, he didn't. And unfortunately, his writings later even helped flame some of the anti-Semitism of this last century. There is a point that he makes that's interesting, because very early in dispensational thinking in the 1800s, a man named John Nelson Darby of the Plymouth Brethren came out with some very positive, influential statements about dispensationalism, putting the Jewish people into another frame of reference, separate and distinct. His concept was such that it actually affected a change in his viewers, his followers' treatment of Jews, so much so that some of his followers during World War II were found by Jews who were looking for refuge. And when they came to their door and knocked at the door quietly, and people came to the door, instead of being horrified by this, they rallied their family together, saying such things as, "Look, God's chosen people have come to us so we can help them." It's a rare occasion, but it happened in different places throughout Europe. Now, there are some contrasting issues. Brog writes about the work of Zionism, but he doesn't mention Brother Russell, and of course that would be economically not good for him, because he works for Hagee, and Hagee wouldn't appreciate Brother Russell's viewpoint on things, I'm sure, although they do know about the work that's being done by Bible students, from what I hear. But I'd like to go with you to the handout again, number 3, and notice the expression about Stephen. Stephen is speaking, and he says that Abraham received no inheritance in the land, but yet it was given to him. And in Genesis 12 and 22 and 26 and 28 and 32 and on and on and on, there are quotations that speak of the blessing, those who will bless thee, and the multiplying of the seed as the stars of heaven and the sand of the seashore. And on and on. There's so many of these different references which are not going to quote, and they're not on your handout, but you know about them. They come after coming to Mount Moriah, when Isaac is receiving his blessing, and Jacob at Bethel, and even when Jacob recalls that blessing, that God would promise him something that his father and grandfather had received, the birthright and the blessing. Moses gave the Israelites warnings, and they are repeated in what is known as the Mount of Blessings and Mount of Curses readings, at when they came into the land, and the reading of the law. One of the key things in Leviticus 26 was, if you walk in my statutes, this is 3a on your handout, and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season. So the promises were to Israel that they would be blessed in basket and store. And of course they were told to keep the Sabbaths, and of course they didn't, and they were warned that if they didn't keep their Sabbaths, the Lord would punish them. We're not going to take time to go into that or into the various timing features of this, which we'd love to concentrate on, but they were mentioned in various ways through the convention. I want to focus now on the portion that is on your handout as 3b, and that has to do with the Jewish double. There are three different statements which are very important, and they do begin with the death of Jacob, these promises, and they come at the time 1813 B.C. The warning of casting off occurs. I will recompense their iniquity. They have defiled my land. This is when the projected, what's going to happen to Israel, is stated in Jeremiah 16, verse 18. And then comes the time of the casting off, Zechariah 9, 12, where he says, I will render unto you double. And that's at the time when Jesus is at the moment of his speaking that they are left desolate. And then finally, at looking backward, we can now look backward at the Isaiah. Comfort ye my people, saith your God, speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for her sins. That's a lot of national punishment. No other nation has been singled out for such punishment. But let's see what it says in Isaiah 51 and Jeremiah 32 and Hosea 2. It's on your handout, number 3C. This, brethren, is the language of comfort. It is not the language of suggesting punishment or chastisement. They have gone through what they have gone through. But when we come to that time at the end of the Jewish double, the end of that period of punishment, we hear the Lord saying these words. Read with me from Isaiah 51. For the Lord shall comfort Zion, he will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. And the voice of the sound of the violin that we heard playing Hatikvah was the hope that they had that these things would be coming true. Oh yes, they were secular, but they hoped in Zion. And Rabbi Kook, who was one of the prominent rabbis of Israel, said, you know, those who are not religious, by coming to the land, they do more in harmony with God's will than the religious observant who stay in diaspora. Jeremiah 32, notice the language. Yea, I will rejoice over them that to do them good, and will plant them in the land assuredly with my whole heart and my whole soul. And in Hosea, therefore, behold, Jehovah speaking, by the way, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her, and I will give her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor for a door of hope, Petah Tikvah, if you will. And she shall sing there in the days of her youth as when she came out of the land of Egypt. These are words of comfort because the Lord loves Zion. What else could we understand from such words from Jehovah God but that he intends to draw a natural Israel to himself, woo her as a man would woo his potential bride, and bring them to his side? But Jesus and the apostles also spoke favorably about Zion. In Luke 21, on handout number 4, we read, and I'll just read you the bold print, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And the Apostle Paul, thinking about his natural brethren, made a most astonishing and almost unspeakable comment in Romans 9. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren. I doubt if any of us could say such words. He said them. And of course, by the time we finish Romans 11, we recognize how much he had hope for them based on the promises of God. In Romans 10, he writes, Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them is for their salvation. But in Romans 10, verse 19, we have the reiteration of Deuteronomy 32. I will make you jealous by that which is not a nation, the Gentiles. By a nation without understanding will I anger you. That certainly has happened. Those who were Gentiles, it is spoken of as this: I was found by those who sought me not. I became manifest to those who did not ask for me. The Gentiles received. They had not been seeking. God has not rejected his people, Romans 11, 1 and 2. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. And finally, in Romans 11, 25 to 27, we'll read just the bold print. A partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. The deliverer will come from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. That, brethren, is the new, the everlasting covenant that shall be made, as was mentioned, and we saw it on our chart of the ages earlier, with Jacob. When? When he removes ungodliness from Jacob. Who will do that? Brethren, if we are faithful, that will be our privilege. But now a little bit more of the darker side of what happened to Christians and their thinking. We know the name, perhaps, Justin Martyr. He was also called Justin of Caesarea. He lived between 100 and 165 A.D. He presented a dialogue of a fictional account with a Jewish scholar, and he reasoned with him. And in that account, he basically said to the Jewish scholar in his writing that Christians have received Abraham's promises because they are more in harmony with Abraham than the Jews. That's the beginning of the seeds of this separation of the Jew from their promises. This is the beginning of replacement theology. Augustine embraced replacement theology. He lived between 354 and 430 AD. Then he began to present his ideas, and these became official church dogma. And he said, though, Israel's house was cast off, finished, no more hope. In fact, he went so far as to suggest, let's not let them die off, though. Now, this is a left-handed or backhanded way of keeping the Jews alive, the Lord arranged for, because Augustine said, we've got to keep them alive, because no one would believe that the books that we have, namely the Bible, were not written by these older people if they're all gone. So we've got to keep them alive so that everybody knows that we didn't make this up ourselves. Oh, such insane reasoning. But it provided a little bit of a way of escape for the Jew who lived in those early centuries. It was up to John Chrysostom who presented, because you Jews killed Christ, there is no mercy. Slay them. Whoops. Now we're into some very heavy-handed anti-Semitic commentary. And that comment resulted in Antioch, where the Christians were first called Christians, the first recorded pogrom against Jews and ritual murder. Oh, it accused them of ritual murder. It accused the Jews there. It's something that has been lingering through the centuries. Well, let's just back up and think about something parallel now. We know that the false church persecuted the true church for how many years? Yes, the time times in half a time, 1260 years. The Jews did not escape during that period. They got more of the same during the same period. And it's perhaps ironic that at the same time as the church is released from this persecuting power of the papal system, it is also the same time that the Code Napoleon says that the Jews, as individuals, should be denied no rights. Interesting. So they kind of come along with us through the persecution, and then there seems to be a breath of fresh air. But even that, and the shock of the French Revolution, which made that possible, and the charges of deicide, which were in a sense pushed aside, deicide, God-killing, pushed aside. When Napoleon provided this extra Code Napoleon to places like Italy, the Roman ghetto vanished temporarily. When Napoleon vanished from political power, they went back to the ghetto. So things did not remain the breath of fresh air that they thought was coming to them. Looking back to Brother Russell's time, there's an interesting couple of connections. In 1876, in the Bible Examiner, published by George Storrs, Brother Russell wrote an article which was about the end of the Gentile times. And in that article, in 1876, Brother Russell linked the smiting of the image with Israel being delivered, noting that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles till the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled, and the fulfillment of the deliverance of Jerusalem. Notice the linkage, Brother Russell said, in 1876. In the very first issue of the Towers in 1879, September, page 26, reprint 26. Most of us don't go back that far to read. But if you do, you'll see that he understood very clearly that the Jews would be regathered and that Jerusalem would be inhabited safely and reorganized as a nation. And one more little item of political interest. During Brother Russell's trip in 1891, he prepared some documents to Baron Hirsch and Baron Rothschild regarding the formation of a new government for the Holy Land. He made a political suggestion to these two multimillionaires to see if they could work out a deal for a political state in what was then called Palestine, Judea and Samaria, and the Shomron. None of us, as far as I know, were at the Hippodrome in 1910. There are some of our brethren who were probably still living who could have been there, but I don't know that they were. There were 4,000 Jews, of course, who came to hear Brother Russell speak. They invited him. Why? Because of his non-proselytizing viewpoint, his way of approaching Jewish hopes. And, of course, he had Hatikva presented. I'm not trying to duplicate that. It just occurred to me as I was reading. But please understand, they had hope, and Hatikva was the signal for that. It is the national anthem. In the late 1950s, brethren in New Jersey, I believe, put out a small booklet called The Time to Favor Zion Has Come. It was based on a scripture from Psalm 102. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time of her favor, yea, the set time, is come. Fortunately, there was someone ready with some good ideas and some brethren ready to write them, and a two-column ad, left side, editorial page, New York Times. They don't have that spot available anymore. It's now the lower right on the op-ed page. But there was an ad placed, and 600 Jews apparently wrote in for it. Maybe not all Jews, but mostly. We know that the work in Chicago and the work in New Brunswick and other places have put out material for people to read and see, and we know that Israel Appointment with Destiny has been presented. And one particular showing was at the La Rome Hotel, where 1,200 Jews came to and saw Israel Appointment with Destiny. Before I leave this particular area of thinking, I would like to encourage you to realize that Brother Russell did present in the Overland Monthly a series of 12 articles. If you have never read them, please reach onto your shelf, take down the booklet, or the book rather, the Overland Monthly. If you don't have one, the book table will be happy to provide you with one as soon as they can. Comments from the Seventh Messenger, the very last article, God's Chosen People. The last section, avoid Christian sects. Why? Well, on your handout, you'll see we have that little piece, and it is the last of the center portion. And some of the pieces on there are in bold print. I'd like to just read the last of those. But those Jews who believe in the Abrahamic promise, in God's testimony through the prophets, in the message of Moses and the law, cannot identify themselves with any other nation or with any other religion. Unfortunately, most of the folks out there who are pressing for various Christian ideas to be swooped into the Jewish community are absolutely interested in one thing, and that is the future conversion of the Jews en masse. Why? Because, brethren, they have no other hope for the Jews than what is immediately available. they must either convert them or they lose them forever. In the past, they didn't care. But with Darby and the dispensationalists and the current Jewish community, friends of the Jewish community, they are thinking that they will actually achieve a conversion of some measure. We won't go into the details just yet. But right now, those who are trying to be comforting to Israel outside of our fellowship realize how much of a crisis Israel is facing. And I strongly encourage you to take a look, if you have internet access, to Arutz 7, A7, is IsraelNN.com, because on there you will hear and read and see the thinking of the Orthodox Jewish community. That kind of community that Brother Russell said would have faith in the land. They were not the first to go up, but they are there now. And they are occupying what is called the West Bank. They're in Judea and Samaria, which is the proper names for those places. It doesn't take much imagination to figure out that they need help. And the Jewish community is willing to accept the help of their would-be friends. Would-be friends whose bottom line is no longer this supersessionism or replacement theology, but rather, let's work with these Jewish people. Eventually, we know, we'll be able to convert them. That's their hope anyway. We might ask ourselves the question, how could the Holocaust have occurred with so many good Christians in Europe? Well, the answer is that they were well prepared. Jonathan Goldhagen wrote a book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, and they did participate because it was to their advantage to take advantage of the Jew, was to have property, land, and things like that available to them. Phyllis Chesler, with whom we've had some communication, in her book, The New Antisemitism, points out that the focus of antisemitism is now focused on anti-Israel. Makes sense, because after all, this is what the rest of the world seems to be barking at, that the Jews are responsible for this or that. While Darby suggested that there was a great parenthesis, we recognize that Brother Russell also spoke of this kind of a parenthesis when he spoke of the interregnum between the period of Zedekiah and the establishment of the kingdom. So Darby wasn't alone, and Brother Russell didn't ignore this concept. But Darby never came to understanding the full blessings that Brother showed us with the chart and how Israel will be the source, the light unto the Gentiles. You know what the bottom line of most of these Christians is? 3/4 of the world will be toast. 2/3 of the Jews will be toast. Some friends. The Jews don't believe the Christians when they talk about their Messiah or about their doom. So it really doesn't matter. And they're happy for the help. So they take it. You've heard us speak in the past on the stars and the sand. And the second half of the handout that you have is really a newsletter that was published out east. And in that, you will see certain key points about the Abrahamic covenant and how the Lord intends to bless his people. First the stars and then the sand. And that sand, that nation of Israel, will come forward and be a blesser nation. In the box just below the menorah on the page that you have, I think it's this last inside fold, it says, at this present time there is a remnant according to the election of grace, but if some of the branches were broken off and you Gentiles being wild olive were grafted in amongst them and become partakers of them, the root and the branch of the olive, Paul is basically pointing out to us that the promises to Israel are not going to be revoked. They are irrevocable. And then he tells them in verse 18 and 23 and 24, don't be arrogant. And notice he says this to the Roman church, which just happens to turn out to be the arrogant source. But they don't be arrogant. Remember, God can easily put them back into the original place where they were grafted out or cut off of. When you were grafted in, you can be cut off, they can be put back in. So he's trying to warn the Christians not to be arrogant, not to do what amounted to a replacement theology. Blindness in part has happened unto Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Some of the Christian Zionists are so intense on this that they have become very strong political advocates. They go right into Congress. They're trying to elect congressmen. They have their own agenda. That's not our thing. No way should it be. They also go there with lots of money. We're not going to be able to compete with the millions of dollars that they are handing over to Israel. What can we do? We can pray. We can keep in mind and heart the scriptures that are in Isaiah. We love Isaiah 52. How beautiful upon the mountain are the feet of him. You know, they are watchmen. They are watchmen in Isaiah 52. And they are watchmen also in Isaiah 62, which we'll read shortly. But keep in mind the thought that we're trying to get here, that we, as the followers of Jesus, are not only watchmen and heralds, but we are also watchmen about the kingdom, but also about how Israel will be restored. All the efforts of the nations, or these Christians who are trying to get political power moved this way and that way, will eventually come to naught. Why? Well, for one reason, it says in Jeremiah 30, verse 14, that all her lovers will leave her. But remember this. Let's look at Isaiah. I should have had this in your text, but I don't. So let's look at Jeremiah 30. Verse 11. It's a very beautiful text. I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure. They have been put through all kinds of persecution and trouble and punishment. When we look at the handout again, right after that, all your lovers have forgotten you. Notice what it says in Jeremiah 46. I shall make a full end of all nations where I have driven you. Yet I shall not make a full end of you, but I will correct you properly and by no means leave you unpunished. The point being that as we come to the time of the end, and the time when we speak of it as Gog and Magog, this concluding portion, in a sense the end of the Jacob's trouble experiences, that concluding portion is one where the nations will suffer. A lot of us just think that Israel is going to be the only ones that suffer, perhaps. Not so. They've been punished quite a bit, as you know, already. Now, how shall we deal with the Jew at this point? Shall we follow Brother Russell's pattern of making no effort to convert natural Israel, the seed of Jacob? Or shall we press on and present the message of Christ? You know, in one way, Brother Russell's day, the Rabinovitch movement, was to him an example of how the Jews were already recovering from their blindness. But that kind of faded. But you know, if the Messianic Jew has accepted Christ, that is, someone who was Jewish, literally becomes a believer, they become a prime source for individuals who could learn the truth. You know, it's difficult for some of us, because out of a good conscience, brethren do feel that they should not hide Christ from the Jew. But in reality, I have felt this way also. I have felt that this is something I don't want to do. I don't want to hide the Jew, Christ from the Jew. But the fact that he knows I'm a Christian, I'm not hiding anything. And our literature is fully available to anyone who wants to read it. But to focus in and specifically target the Jew is another issue. Well, I would suggest that if we feel very strongly about reaching out to Jews, the best ones we might want to reach out to are the Jews for Jesus or the Messianic Jews. Why? They're already Christians. And where are they? They're locked up in nominal church doctrine. What do they need? They need to be freed from that. How do they do that? That's the hardest part. They tend to be very well prepared against groups like ours. They've been informed about our teachings. I remember walking through a bus terminal in New York and chatting with one of these fellows back in the early 70s. His comment was very simple. The dawn? You know, he was very opposed to it. Why? Because he knew what we believed. That's what it was like. They were tuned up against our teachings. Those are the ones, though, who need to get the encouragement. The other Jews, they have a lot of years of experiences of difficulty, very hard to deal with. But on the other hand, we know that they will be blessed and they will be part of that blesser seed. And evidently, that's the way the Lord has arranged things. Remember, if any of them have a relationship at all, some might think they could even be begotten of the Spirit if they have accepted Christ. But the bottom line is, if any of them have any relationship, the question is how to get them to have the Lord have a relationship with them. And that is to give them the truth. And they are already believers. You don't have to jump over that fence. So, shouldn't Christian Zionists be watchmen? The summer of the peaceable kingdom is coming close. We all pray for it. Consider these words from Isaiah 62. Remember I mentioned the parallel to Isaiah 52, watchmen? On your walls, O Jerusalem, it's on the handout, I have appointed watchmen. All day and all night will never keep silent. They will never keep silent. You who remind the Lord, take no rest for yourselves. Give him no rest. Give the Lord. Imagine the word prophet saying, give the Lord Jehovah no rest. He never sleeps. Give him no rest until he establishes and makes Jerusalem a praise in the earth. Of course, in praying for the kingdom, we pray for that very thing. All nations of the earth will be blessed, but it will come from the church, the earthly government, the ancient worthies, and Israel, with whom the new covenant will be made. These are the beautiful teachings. So just as Moses was used to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt, we, with Jesus, our head, will be as Moses. And this is the concept of the greater than Moses. This is the concept of Acts 3:23. Bringing the children of Israel with a mixed multitude out of slavery, the bondage of sin and death. Brethren, in that deliverance, the Jews will be a light to the Gentiles. They'll teach the Gentile world about Christ's kingdom. And you wonder, why were they scattered all over the earth? What a better group of people can you pick than people who've lived all over the earth to help all the people all over the earth when the kingdom is being established? And of course, they have the blessing of being part of the seed of Jacob. Israel will be as the sand of the Abrahamic seed of blessing. And that seed will be the whole earth, all the sand, the whole earth. And the true Zionists, the true believers, will be the stars in heaven. In reality, we love Israel because God loves Israel. And because we will work together with Israel to bless all the families of the earth. And it's my prayer for you and my prayer for myself, and I hope you'll pray for me, that we can be faithful watchmen. Watchmen declaring, "Thy God reigneth," Isaiah 52. And this other statement, give the Lord no rest until he establish and make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. May the Lord add his blessing.